We're talking about the work of the Republican Party of Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 2020 presidential election is about 16 months away, and state Republicans are actively working on a grassroots campaign push to build the base. We're taking a look at priorities with the chairman, gathering your questions along the way. What do you want to know about organizing and party priorities? What issues do you think the Republican Party should be working on to address here in Wisconsin? And what issues do you want to hear lawmakers and candidates talking about? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrew Hitt is an attorney in Madison. He was deputy legal counsel and senior advisor to former Governor Scott Walker. He was elected chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin in April. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here today. Thanks for the invitation. Looking forward to talking and talking to your listeners.
Yeah, well, let's start a bit more big picture-ish and then zoom in. What are your top priorities for the Republican Party of Wisconsin as you hit the ground running here? What are the most important issues that you're working on right now?
First and foremost, the most important issue is really making RPW a grassroots organizing organization. That's my top priority. We win elections when we have a focus on the grassroots, when we have this army of people out there knocking on doors, making phone calls. So right now I'm focused on sort of the blocking and tackling, making sure that they have the information they need, the data they need, tools that they need to get out the vote in 2020.
What are some of the other issues that really rise to the top for you?
Yeah, great question. So, I'm really focused on, really taking a look at meeting people where they are. We can't cede parts of the state. We can't just ignore Dane County. We can't ignore Milwaukee County. We have to work hard to talk to people in those areas. There's a lot of raw Republican vote totals in Dane County, in Milwaukee County. And so we're putting together and have put together a minority outreach program. I think it's probably one of the strongest, if not the strongest, programs we've had in Wisconsin for RPW. We've got people on the ground already that have built relationships over the last couple of years. We kept them on staff after 2018. Normally, we would decrease staff in that area. We kept them on. We funded that. And we're doing significant outreach in that area. The other area that I want to focus on is local office recruitment to build the farm team for long term. It's a little bit of a longer term goal, but I think it's an important one to grow the party.
When you talk about farm team, what do you mean by that? What are you referring to?
So, I want to make sure that we have a group of individuals that, as the speaker and the majority leader, are looking for people to run for election in the assembly and the Senate. They have a good group of people to pick from. And I think focusing on local office, recruiting for local office, and making sure that we have good conservative candidates who are getting some training in that area of government is a great place to take these people and move them up in government and as they go through their goals of being an elected official.
Oh, so you're looking at like school boards and city councils and saying, hey,
who are
these people here who might have something more in them that could serve us in the legislature?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Using that group of people to really grow the Republican Party. We have to take a focus really on growing the party, growing out our volunteers, and energizing for 2020.
Wisconsin voters elected Judge Brian Hagedorn to the state Supreme Court this spring. He was the candidate, as you know, with the Republican Party's support. You're very close to Judge Hagedorn. What did this victory prove for you? What did the party learn?
Yeah, well, I'm very close with him. We clerked together in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and we worked together in the governor's office. I think he's going to be a really amazing rule of law judge. Very excited about that. I think for us, it was a little bit of a proof of concept. As we looked at, in hindsight, what occurred in 2018, what we did, more importantly, what we didn't do, we made changes going into the 2019 cycle and into that race, much more of a focus on the grassroots, making sure that we were communicating with them, and not just weekly, but daily, making sure that they had tools that they needed to elect the judge. And so we made some changes from 2018 to 2019. I think those changes worked. It was a proof of concept for us. Certainly is the playbook going into 2020 as we look to reelect the president and vote, get Republicans elected up and down the ballot.
Let's take a call now. Let's bring in Steve joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, one of the concerns I have about conservatism in general, not just Republican Party, but conservatism, is that our media is probably 98% liberal, if not 100% liberal. And most of the kids in our state go to public school that is dominated by a liberal indoctrination program by the unions. So kids don't hear the benefits of conservatism in their daily lives. What could the Republican Party do to help reach these kids so they don't just hear negative, negative, negative about Republicans from supposedly their role models and teachers or the media?
Andrew, what do you see there in Steve's question?
Yeah, so, I mean, that really gets to my point about meeting people where they are. You know, whether it's our minority outreach program or our youth outreach program, we need to meet people where they are and talk to them about issues that they care about. When we're talking about the youth vote, we can't just focus on college. A lot of people want to focus on, you know, the college vote, and that's a focus of mine as well. But we have to remember that there are young men and women, 18 to 25 year olds, all over this state who are conservative in their thoughts and their principles. And they are people who are either wanting to vote for the president, or if we reached out to them, they would vote for the president. So we have to meet people where they are and talk to them about things that they care about. As we're talking to the youth, we need to make sure that they understand that we're a party that appreciates their independence and fosters their independence and their freedom. And I think as the Democrats are talking an awful lot about government and a government takeover of a lot of different things, I think that's a message that resonates with young people. And then I think, you know, we all have to do a better job as parents, as people in the community, about making sure we're reaching out to young people, that we're, you know, mentoring them, that we're spending time with them. Because, you know, we don't want them to forget some of the history that we've gone through. And I think this is an important time to do that, as we seem to see more and more talk from the left about socialism and so-called democratic socialism.
We're talking with the chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Andrew Hitt. We're exploring the ground game of the party, a grassroots effort, as he's been talking about. So where do you see room for Republicans and Democrats to work together? What bipartisan topics should lawmakers be addressing? What is your reflection on the years of Republican Party control in state government? Join in this conversation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Republican Party of Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Economic prosperity, limited government, fiscal restraint, some of the themes that we're hearing emerging from party leadership, a strong ground game, as they call it in politics, going door to door, talking with voters, gathering your questions as the party in Wisconsin gears up for the 2020 presidential election and state races. So what is your reflection on the years of Republican Party control in state government? What can be done to improve or extend leadership? What suggestions or ideas do you have for the chairman of the state's Republican Party? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Republican Party Chair Andrew Hitt stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Mark joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the call. Chairman, I'm an independent voter from Green Bay, and I was paying attention to the special session called in December. I've heard a lot of coverage about that session that's unfavorable to it. So that's certainly the perspective that I've taken on with it. But I'm wondering if you, on behalf of the Republican Party, can maybe frame that special session in a different context, because it's certainly currently a factor in how I view the 2020 election.
And so you're referring to, Mark, there what has been called the lame duck session or the extraordinary session. And last week, state Supreme Court ruled that Republican lawmakers were acting within their rights when they passed laws during the lame duck session that limited the powers of Governor Evers and Attorney General Josh Call. Andrew?
Well, great. First of all, it's great to talk to you, being from Green Bay. So I actually live in Appleton, although, you know, sometimes I get referred to as a Madison or Milwaukee attorney because of where my day job is. So it's great to talk to you. I think there's a couple things that I would say on the lame duck, the so-called lame duck laws. First of all, not surprised that the Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld those laws. Long-standing precedent that the legislature has the power to govern itself. And had these laws been struck down, it would call into question decades of past extraordinary sessions. But to really hone in on your question, on whether or not there was something that the Republicans did wrong by passing these laws in December, I look back and I think about the timeline. We have a transfer of government that occurs after a November election, and it occurs in January. If the Republicans had done something, if we had done something like the transfer of power was November 10th, and you know the election was a few days earlier, and we changed that from November 10th to January 7th in order to pass these laws, then maybe the Democrats would have had a leg to stand on. But that's not what happened. There's a reason that there is this long period, not only for a transfer of government, but so that the legislature and the current leadership can wrap things up.
But Andrew Hitt, does it concern you at all that future governors, future attorneys general will have less power?
You know, no, I mean, not really. I think that the people have an opportunity to speak, and that if for some reason the focus is a little bit too much power was taken away from the attorney general, the people have an opportunity to speak and to be heard, and they can do that right now. So, you know, there is opportunities to vote and to speak your mind on this. I don't think that what we did in the fall or in the December session was improper at all. I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court said it very clearly. The legislature had the power to do what it did. And it makes sense that they are able to come back in before the transfer of power. This isn't like we changed the date of when the transfer of power was.
So you would characterize that this rebalancing of the powers of government was a long time in coming?
Well, I think what the legislators have said is, you know, during the 8 years of complete Republican control, there are some things that they gave powers to some folks that as they looked at it in hindsight, they thought maybe it was too much. And so I certainly respect them for their opinions and their ability to legislate. And, I think they did a good job in December balancing out power for the future.
You advised Governor Scott Walker specifically on health care. And I know Carol in Milwaukee would like to bring up health care. Carol, hi.
Yes, am I on the air?
Yes, you are, Carol. Go ahead.
Okay. I believe I would like to know if there are any Republicans who would be willing to back the Badger Care expansion, which means accepting money from the federal government so that 80,000 new Wisconsinites could have insurance. Are there any Republicans like that that would help to bring that back into the budget, even though it's the Republicans already basically took it out?
Carol, thanks for the call. What do we know, Andrew, about how Republicans feel about Medicare expansion? Medicaid,
sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I think some history is important context here. So when Governor Walker was, back a few years ago working on this issue, he developed a plan where there was no coverage gap in Wisconsin. And if we were outside of politics, there'd be a lot of people that said, wow, that's really great. There is no coverage gap. And that first point is important. The second point is what Governor Walker did was, at that time, childless adults were able to be covered above 100% of FPL, or federal poverty line. But there was a cap, that was an enrollment cap, that was put on by the Doyle administration. So in effect, the effective rate was essentially 25%. What Governor Walker did was he moved that effective rate. He took that off and he said anybody below poverty is entitled to has the opportunity to enroll in Medicaid. And so he put 80,000 people, childless adults who were the poorest of the poor, who didn't have Medicaid, and he put them on Medicaid. He took 80,000 people that were above 100% FPL, and he allowed, he gave them an opportunity to go on the exchange. So the Republicans have provided an opportunity for coverage for everybody. I think fundamentally the difference between Republicans and Democrats on Medicaid expansion is really this. Republicans see Medicaid as a safety net program. We want it to be there. We want it to be a safety net program for folks, so when they need it, it's there. And we want to have policies in place to pull people up and out of poverty so they don't need Medicaid. I think Democrats look at it more as it's a health care for all program. So I think fundamentally that difference in philosophy drives some of the decision making that's going on between Republicans and Democrats on the issue. But most importantly, let's not forget that there's no coverage gap in Wisconsin, and that while the money that we may get, if we expanded right now, looks nice, it's not money that is necessarily here to stay, and that puts the state in jeopardy, that puts the fiscal coffers in jeopardy. The prudent thing to do is really what we have done, which is stabilize the insurance market. Make sure that there's no coverage gap and that people have an opportunity for care.
Let's stay along these lines, healthcare, with Trey joining us from Southern Wisconsin. Trey, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask the chairman one thing. He mentioned about limited government and personal lives, and I'm just wondering how they can say that when they still want to restrict women's health cares. I mean, they don't want regulations on corporations, but they want regulations on women's vaginas. So I need some clarification on where they stand on that.
Well, last week, Governor Evers vetoed 4 abortion-related bills that had made it out of the legislature and onto his desk. So what do you see there, Andrew Hitt?
Sure. Well, I think what you're ignoring there is that these innocent lives should have rights too. And so that's a fundamental difference of opinion that I think you and I probably have there. But if we look at the bills that were vetoed last week, the Democrats really have moved so far in defense of abortion that they're outside of the mainstream now. And I think they're outside of what everyday Wisconsinites would find acceptable. I mean, we're talking about limiting or preventing late-term abortion. We're talking about making sure that if a baby is born alive, that doctors care for those babies. Those are the things that we're talking about right now. And, you know, it's surprising that the Democrats would go so far to defend abortion at any rate, at any cause. And they would ignore the focus that is on late-term abortion and the Born Alive bill.
Well, Andrew, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you today.
Andrew Hitt is chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Last week, we spoke with Ben Wickler, chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Coming up, intellectual humility, someone's willingness to consider the possibility that they might be wrong. We'll discuss it right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about intellectual humility here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's this human trait that allows us to admit when we're wrong, to be humble and curious, to better appreciate our blind spots, to be able to bravely say, hey, you know what? I was wrong. And there's new research that says intellectual humility is in short supply, especially in our political world. Do you think you're more willing than others to admit you're wrong? Tell us about a time you had an argument with someone and you realized that, you know what, you were incorrect. How did you overcome the urge to fight for your viewpoint? Do you think media makes it more difficult to admit error? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mark Leary studies intellectual humility as a social and personality psychologist. He researches motivation and emotion, self-awareness, and psychological well-being. He just retired this week as a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Glad to be here.
Well, good morning and happy retirement.
Thank you very much. It doesn't feel that way yet, but we'll get there.
So, intellectual humility, why did you get onto this topic? What is it that fascinates you here?
Well, what fascinates me is the fact that there's a general human tendency to overestimate how correct we are. Virtually everybody does that. But people do differ in their ability to see that whatever they might believe, whatever their beliefs and opinions might be, they might potentially be incorrect. And it simply seemed to us that the failure to recognize the possibility that you are sometimes incorrect creates a lot of problems in people's lives, not just the kinds of conflicts that you were talking about in your introduction, but just navigating your world believing that you already sort of know everything and that whatever you think is right can be a problem. So we've spent the last 4 or 5 years conducting research, and a lot of other people have joined in. There's a lot of researchers out there starting to study this topic now.
Well, when you look at something like this, you immediately want to say, well, how do you measure intellectual humility? Is there some way we can quantify this, put it in a bottle? Is there a test that we can do? What do you see there?
Anytime we start trying to measure something, psychologists, of course, gravitate to self-report questionnaires because they're easy and they're cheap. And so a number of people have to try to develop questionnaires that ask people about how open-minded they are. Are you willing to reconsider your views when they might be incorrect? Do you recognize that you are sometimes incorrect about things? How incorrect do you think you are? What's the probability that in any given argument you have with other people that you might in fact be wrong? And what we find is, in general, not talking about the trait of intellectual humility, but the average person believes that when they're in a disagreement with somebody, that they are the one who's right about 2/3 of the time. And so we have a world full of people, all of whom think they're the one that's right. But people differ along that, and they're able to report on it. And we have some pretty good, well-validated measures of intellectual humility that have been tested and shown to actually assess people's willingness to recognize they might be wrong.
So when you ask people to think about the percentage of times they were right in an argument, the average response was about 66%. What can you attribute that to?
There are a lot of things. We all have a need to believe that our view of the world is correct. and our opinions are correct. There's a lot of uncertainty involved if you walk through life always wondering whether everything you thought was true might in fact be incorrect. So there are a lot of people who are just unsettled. It's hard for them to act as if they're right while knowing that they might not be. And that's sort of the trick in being intellectually humble. Intellectual humility is not going through life just being uncertain about everything. You have to believe things in order to function in life, but you have to be able to act as if you're right while still being open to the possibility that you might be wrong. And if evidence comes along, you would change your beliefs.
Do you have any longitudinal look at this, like historical look? Are we at a unique point in our history as a country in this way? Are we less likely to admit that we're wrong than in previous decades?
I haven't seen any data on that. My hunch is the answer is probably not. If you think about other times in our history, let's take the period of the Civil War. Did Northerners and Southerners, did either of them have doubts that their views were correct? And the answer is probably not. Mm-hmm. I think it's more obvious today because of social media and, you know, the 24/7 news cycle where people are expressing their views and the certainty of their views and arguing with one another 24 hours a day. And we can see that, and we can flame out on the internet or on Facebook, and people flame out on us. So I think it's more obvious, but it's a feature of human nature that all of us believe, or just about everybody believes, they're more correct than they are. But some people are more likely to believe that, and some people recognize they might be wrong, and those are the intellectually humble ones.
Are there tendencies to hear like this echo chamber effect or groupthink?
Well, certainly the less intellectually humble a person is, the more likely they are to avoid evidence that contradicts what they already think. So they're more likely to gravitate toward echo chambers. It's more disturbing to them to consider the possibility they might be wrong, and so they avoid any of that sort of evidence.
Mark Leary is a social and personality psychologist studying intellectual humility. He recently retired from Duke University as a professor of psychology and neuroscience. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. So do you think the media makes it harder to admit we're wrong? What about social media? Has that created an echo chamber? What questions do you have for our psychologist about intellectual humility? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. So what good can come from people changing their minds about things, Mark? What are the benefits from having a higher degree of intellectual humility?
There are a number. At the personal level, I think people make better decisions if they're willing to consider the possibility that what they think might be wrong. If you charge through life thinking that everything that I'm thinking and doing is correct, you never catch yourself potentially making a mistake. So we don't have data on this, but I believe that more intellectually humble people probably see the world a little more clearly and they make better decisions. People who are more intellectually humble, we know that they have more agreeable interactions with other people, because they're willing to entertain the possibility that even if you and I disagree, well, you might be correct. So I'm not going to really come down on you and argue with you. So they actually have more pleasant social lives. We have a study showing they have more satisfying marriages if they or their partner is higher in intellectual humility. And we can come back to that because people always find that sort of thing interesting. Mm-hmm. In the workplace or in politics, you know, an awful lot of good decisions require negotiation and compromise, that any given person doesn't have the whole picture, doesn't have the accurate view. So if you have a number of people around the table trying to make an important decision, their flexibility in accommodating the views of others, it doesn't mean they have to cave in and always go along with the others, but to at least consider the possibility that other people have something to offer, I think creates for better negotiations and better decisions in the long run. And there's also evidence that, for example, at work, the more intellectually humble a boss is, the more the employees contribute their ideas to the good of the organization. An intellectually arrogant boss is always going to come down on people who have ideas that are different than his. But an intellectually humble boss will allow those ideas to come out and they might turn into something useful. So there are a number of benefits, both for our personal lives, for our interactions with other people, and for the quality of decisions that are being made in organizations and presumably in politics.
Well, in stopping there on politics, have you looked more closely at politicians and lawmakers and their ability to have intellectual humility?
We have not studied politicians. You get the sense that everybody is completely convinced of what they believe. We have looked at citizens. We have looked at voters and how their intellectual humility plays out in their political beliefs. Now, there are stereotypes of people with certain political attitudes that some are more intellectually humble and more intellectually arrogant than others. But in several studies, we have not found average differences in intellectual humility between Democrats and Republicans, between conservatives and liberals, which, you know, will surprise some people, I think. We do find that conservatives and liberals differ on the topics that they are most intellectually arrogant about, but the number of things they're intellectually arrogant about don't really differ. For example, just to give you an example, conservative voters are more convinced that their views of voter ID, of tax policy, of affirmative action are correct. But liberal voters are more convinced that their attitudes toward government aid for the needy, not basing laws on religion, the use of torture on terrorists, that they're more intellectually arrogant about their views there. But if you look across the board, you don't find a difference between conservatives and liberals. And if you think about that deeply, you can see why. I mean, a really staunch Democrat can be as intellectually arrogant as a really staunch Republican. What we do find is, regardless of political party, people with more extreme views, more extreme conservatism and more extreme liberalism, tend to be less intellectually humble than the people in the middle. Now, you might say, well, that may only make sense, that a moderate would be more intellectually humble. But you could be intellectually arrogant about moderation.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lawmaker might say, yeah, I'd like to be open-minded, but then what if I don't get reelected if I don't really stand behind my views?
And in that case, you know, we sort of have to distinguish, is the person really... Does that speak to the person's intellectual humility, or does that speak to sort of their pragmatic view of what they have to say and do? It's a little unclear to me sometimes watching politicians. Do they really believe this thing as firmly as they're asserting? Maybe they're a very intellectually humble person, but they can't express that intellectual humility or they won't be reelected. So I think we need to tease those two things apart.
We're learning about intellectual humility, this ability to consider the possibility that we might be wrong. Mark Leary is a social and personality psychologist, studies intellectual humility. We're finding out it is in short supply and there are consequences. Why is it so hard to challenge our belief systems? Is it human nature to always be right? Can you remember a time when you fought for a position even though you knew it was faulty? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about intellectual humility, the ability to admit you're wrong. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it can be difficult to acknowledge it. It's something that we see in our homes, in our communities, in politics. President Trump told reporters at a news conference just over a year ago that he believed that North Korea's leader would destroy a nuclear site, but it might not be a sure bet. Here's the president.
I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey, I was wrong. I don't know that I'll ever admit that, but I'll find some kind of an excuse.
What do you wonder about your own intellectual humility? Do you want to know how to get more of it? How to help others improve their level of intellectual humility? Join in 800-642-1234. Psychologist Mark Leary stays with us as he studies intellectual humility. Let's take a call now with Dwayne joining us from Weston. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
A lot of this that you guys are talking about rings true for me is, you know, I've had many managers over the 3 years working at this company, and the ones that were real prideful and wouldn't take advice didn't last for longest. You know, they were too set in their ways, and they're my mother-in-law one time was talking about I've always said a little humility goes a long way. I've said that for a long time and years and years. And one time my mother-in-law was talking about a man in the church they were helping. And I don't think she ever heard this before, and I never did, but she said, just to say a name, Doug, he's very humble. He's a very humble person. And he's got a lot to be humble about. I about fell off my chair. She didn't mean it to be funny. A little humility does go a long way. And, the Bible says pride cometh before destruction or a fall. And I've seen it at work. So I really like this topic.
Well, Dwayne, thanks so much for the call. He brings up a couple of points there. First with religion, he talked about being in church there. How does religion play into intellectual humility?
That's a really good question, because there are some religions that, as part of the doctrine, the religion says this is the only possible view, and you better not believe any other view. There are other religious approaches that are a little more open-minded, that say, well, there's a number of different paths to spiritual truth, and some may be better than others, but you need to sort of find your own. So I do think that the religion that a person grows up in can influence their level of intellectual humility, not just about religion, but also it sort of spreads. I mean, does a child grow up believing that some things that they believe are absolutely perfectly correct and are not open to even questioning or thinking about? And so, we're not encouraging people to give up their religious views, but you sort of wonder how that spreads to other areas of life if someone develops the view that this is the one and only view and I can't possibly ever imagine it being incorrect. So, yeah, religion's interesting. It is not true that religious people are necessarily less intellectually humble than non-religious people. The very ardent atheist is often a very intellectually arrogant sort of character who won't entertain any other possibilities just as much as someone who's highly religious might be. So it's not that religion is somehow producing more intellectual arrogance than non-religion. It's just the fact that it is woven into the fabric of a lot of religious doctrine.
Let's take another call now. Aaron is joining us from Waukesha. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, good morning. I was just curious if in the research you had looked at all at mindfulness meditation or had considered anything in that regard, being that in mindfulness we talk about this non-judgmental awareness and not making any assumptions and kind of pausing and breathing before you draw any conclusions, not coming in with biases. Just curious if you had looked at that or maybe if mindfulness meditation could be a way to cultivate some of this intellectual unbiasedness.
Yeah, Aaron, thanks for that. Mark, what do we know?
That's a great question. And ironically, even though some of my other research deals with mindfulness, and I know that literature pretty well, we have not explored that. But I think the caller is absolutely correct. To the degree that you can quiet down your own thoughts, that you can get some distance from yourself and sort of reduce your egotistical approaches to things, and that you're not being as judgmental, I would feel fairly certain that people who practice mindfulness on average would be somewhat less intellectually arrogant than other people are. I think that's a great question. This is a pretty new research area. It really did only start 4 or 5 years ago. That's a topic that needs to be explored. Great question.
Let's bring in Holly now, joining us from Blue Mounds. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and I do a lot of public defender work, and I spend most of my days in the courtroom with judges and prosecutors, and so my world is filled with, I think, probably what everyone would call intellectually arrogant people and not humble at all. And I'm just wondering if you've searched or done any studies on the legal world or lawyers, because I think we're all, we're sort of, we get a bad rap for being arrogant and always wanting to be right, and it is part of our job, but I wonder if, part of that is, ingrained or is it just the job? I just wondered if you studied that.
Well, is it a learned behavior?
That's a really good question. I was at a conference a couple of months ago in which there were some people with degrees in law, and we had that very discussion and debated where does that come from? The organizational structure of the judicial system insists that you assert your certainty about things. You can't say, you know, my client is innocent, but, you know, I could be wrong about that. You can't do that if you're a defender. So the system and the role requires assertions of certainty. Now, whether the people themselves outside of the professional context are more or less intellectually humble people than other people, we don't know. There were some of the lawyers who believed that people who gravitate to law somehow might be less intellectually humble than the average person. And those were lawyers asserting that. I don't have any evidence of that whatsoever, but it's a great question.
Do we see any gender differences in terms of who has more intellectual humility?
Some studies show very slight, significant, but very small differences where men are slightly more intellectually arrogant. But they're very small differences, and they don't show up in every study. What we do find is a hint that men who are low in intellectual humility display their lack of intellectual humility in a somewhat more toxic or antisocial fashion than women who are low in intellectual humility do. I assume it has to do with differences in how the genders are socialized and how they're socialized to deal with conflict and disagreement, that if you have a man and a woman who are both equally low in intellectual humility, I think you're going to be able to see it more in the man than the woman, and he's going to be a little more disagreeable about it.
Well, let's circle back to what you had touched so briefly on with spouses and in marriage. What do you see happen with intellectual humility?
What we see is sort of what I just described there. We did a study where we had almost 100 heterosexual couples who had been together between 6 months and 42 years, as I remember. So these are long-term couples. We got both couples. We separated them. They completed measures of intellectual humility. And then they each answered questions about their satisfaction with the relationship and the behaviors of their partner. And what you find is that relationships in which you have a male who is low in intellectual humility fare far worse than all other combinations. That if there's an intellectually arrogant man in the relationship, he's not satisfied with the relationship or the partner, and she's not satisfied with him. Her level of intellectual humility doesn't have as much of an impact either on how she feels about the relationship or how he feels about her. But men who are low in intellectual humility tend to have less satisfying relationships, both from their perspective and from their partners.
Well, Mark, thank you for exploring this with us.
It's great talking with you.
Mark Leary is a social and personality psychologist studying intellectual humility. He retired this week from his post as a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Just ahead, we take the temperature of the U.S. economy and we break down all of your curious pocketbook questions with an economics explainer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.